Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Homebrewers Association. The American Homebrewers Association invites you to choose your own brew venture. Join for 1 year and select a complimentary brewing book from Brewers Publications. Choose from more than 60 titles to match your brewing goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to join the American Homebrewers Association and treat yourself to a new brewing book. Get offer details at homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing. That's homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 30th, 2023. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we head to my hometown of Hot Springs, Arkansas to visit Origami Sake, a brand new sake brewery under construction. We'll talk to Ben Bell and Justin Potts and sample some of their early test batches. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters this week will see an early release of the video episode featuring my Vienna Lager. It's the season of lagers. I've now brewed 4 lagers in a row. I think that's definitely a record for me. Financial supporters will also get the recipe and a behind-the-scenes video of how that beer came together. My second run at brewing another lager, a Hellesbach, is now in the keg. If you're keeping up, Chris Colby and I formulated that recipe on a previous episode of this show. I brewed it, and it was a little darker than I expected. A lot darker than expected, and I discovered that thanks to a mix-up, I had the wrong ingredients. I was given 20 Lovibond caramel in Vienna instead of just Vienna malt. I rebrewed it with the proper ingredients, and it is, as you would expect, lighter in color. It finished lower in gravity, but maybe not as much lower as you'd anticipate. Both are going to be big, tasty beers, I think. Big old 7-plus ABV beers heading into summertime. I got the ingredients for that second batch by ordering from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave at HighGravityBrew.com. You know, usually I spend a lot of time talking about their Warthog electric systems, which I love. Mine has definitely taken the pain out of propane. But you can't forget that High Gravity in Tulsa is also a full-service homebrew store and has been for coming up on 2 decades. They've expanded into brewing commercially at the store, but they definitely haven't forgotten us homebrewers. I ordered my ingredients on highgravitybrew.com using the Build Your Own Beer page. All the ingredients you need to design a delicious beer are on one scrolling page, and as you add items, the total updates at the bottom of the window, which is very handy. I got timely updates of my order status, and everything arrived at my door in great shape. Check them out at highgravitybrew.com and use the code EBC75BB. to save $75 off your Warthog electric gear purchase. And if you're traveling through Tulsa, stop by and have a pint at Pippin's Tap Room and be sure to tell them that we said hi. That's at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. Okay, we've talked sake a few times on this show. I've sampled some delicious sake, including home-brewed examples. I'm intimidated by the sake brewing process myself, but I find it very fascinating. And I was extremely excited to hear that there's a sake brewery being built in my hometown. And really excited to visit there to talk to Ben Bell and Justin Potts of Origami Sake about what they're building and to sample some of their wares. Ben Bell, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And Justin Potts, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for paying us a visit. Good to see you.
I'm so excited. And also, on the sidelines, not saying anything, is our friend Kelly Dodson, who we may get him to ask get enough sake in him. Maybe he'll ask a question. We are here at I'm so excited. We're here in my hometown, in Kelly's hometown. And I can't believe that I'm about to say that we're at a sake brewery. in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Now, who wants to tell the origin story? Ben, do you want to tell the origin story?
I will tell that as an Arkansas native, born in Little Rock, and I grew up in Sheridan. Of course, a lot of people don't know it, but Arkansas is the number one rice grower in the U.S. We grow about half of all the rice that's grown, and the Mississippi River Delta really is the bulk of it in the U.S. So Louisiana's big, Mississippi's big, but I've been in the alcohol business for a while, and I knew Arkansas being the number one rice grower and sake being made from rice. Maybe there was something to do with that. And I think just because I was in the business, I was able to push little by little over now about 15 years to finally get to the sake brewery we're in right now.
And you're still under construction, but you're making product in the beginning stages. And you took us on a tour of the facility, which it's impressive already, and it's going to be really impressive once you're done. So you're just getting started, right?
Yeah, that's right. We're actually, as of the time of this recording, not open yet. So we will be open this year. We will be selling sake this year. Still the preparation is hot and heavy.
So how did you get into sake? I mean, it makes sense that you would come, brew sake in Arkansas, since there's so much grown here. Mm-hmm. And you would come to a town that's known for water, for good quality water. Yeah. How did you get into it as a home brewer?
So I got a job at a liquor store in Little Rock. Shout out to Colonial Wines. And I knew nothing about drinks, and I knew that Cabernet was red and Chardonnay was white, but I just had to learn more about what I was selling to help customers, and from that ended up getting a certification in wine, and really just started coming up in the business. And I remember one day a sake came to the store that was not the usual stuff that I, you'd kind of see everywhere. And, it was a little pricey, and I just wanted to know what the deal was. So I took it home, and because I knew, my basis was in wine, it looked like white wine to me. So I kept it in the fridge, and then I poured it into a white wine glass and drank it that way. And I was very impressed with the quality, kind of stunned. And I thought, okay, if sake can be like this, maybe there really is something to do with sake in Arkansas, in the rice state. So that started me on the journey.
And we've got to be introduced to Justin. Justin, what's your story?
My story. Which version would you like? There's no...
The clean one.
The clean one. So I'm from the Seattle area. Originally, I was born and raised in the greater Seattle area. I went to Japan initially in about 2004, and I've been there just about ever since. I didn't have a really good reason to go in the first place, aside from just having a travel bug. Long story short, in the process of figuring out what life looks like in Japan, I got into working with a lot of rural growers and producers of a lot of different food products, farmers, rice farmers and things, but also tomato growers or apple farmers and things like that, as well as producers making a lot of more, for lack of a better word, I guess, traditional products. So things like soy sauce, like miso, mirin, sake. And in doing that, at that time, my role was more, how do I take these really fantastic things that are being grown or made in rural parts of Japan that are going undervalued and underappreciated, and how do I connect those with people who will actually appreciate them? Was sort of the job that I sort of fell into. And so I was doing that both domestically for the domestic market as well as the international market. And in doing that, I discovered the world of koji, which I imagine we'll probably talk about a little bit later. When I first came in contact with that, I had a bit of trouble wrapping my mind around it. But the one thing that I did notice or realize very quickly was that koji was sort of a through line between all of this shared vocabulary that's known around the world. All around the world, people know the word sake. They know the word miso. They know soy sauce. right? Whether or not they understand exactly what it is or how it's made is maybe another question. But this is all a shared vocabulary, and everybody has a very positive, generally positive association with these things. You know, when you associate that with Japanese food, Japanese cuisine, healthy, fantastic flavor, whatnot. And the through line between all those things is this stuff called koji. And that just sort of blew my mind. And I was like, how is this something that nobody's talking about? Obviously, there's the through line of fermentation, but the more hyper-specific one that is really unique to Japan was this koji element. And then at the time, you know, even, you know, Googling in Japanese, I couldn't find good information on koji. A lot has changed now, both domestically and in Japan as well, too. But yeah, basically as an extension of my work, I just started doing more things associated with koji. And from there, met a handful of just really inspirational sake makers in Japan who basically taught me what it means to make sake and sort of its relationship to fermentation, its relationship to agriculture and sort of the livelihoods of people in Japan and the larger culture around it. And that, yeah, basically just set me down a path of trying to figure out what is the best version of that for my life in Japan, and how can I contribute to the people that are already making great things there. And so in doing that, I started working with a lot more sake breweries. I got into making sake. I worked at a couple of breweries there for several years. And I've been there for a long, long time. And I assumed my home would be there until I was chatting with Ben this summer. And about 24 hours later, I decided to pick up and move my family to Hot Springs, Arkansas to make some sake. So
easy. There we are. I really like your story compared to mine, which was I got a job at a liquor store.
Both are valid.
Yeah. They are. We are sitting next to each right? other right now. Yes. Making sake. Wow. So it's okay.
Wow. And wow. I'm interested to hear what other things Ben has sold people over the years. If he can change your life in a very short period of time,
yeah. Mostly alcohol.
It's just been alcohol. Yeah, but I mean, there are some other like kind of key points for me. I did find out when I started homebrewing with one of my friends that there was a farmer in Arkansas who was growing real sake rice, name of Chris Isbell, and the Isbell family Farms had been growing Japanese varietals, I think, since the 80s, and were really well known for it. Already a famous farming family. Actually, Chris was just inducted into the Arkansas Agricultural Hall of Fame. I got to go to the induction ceremony. It was great. So them knowing that they were already growing not just Japanese varietals, but actual sake rice, specifically a varietal called Yamada Nishiki, that gave me a lot more confidence to continue with making sake in Arkansas. So they played a really big role in it. Also, Hot Springs specifically, of course, Hot Springs has famous water. Mm-hmm. But did you know that Hot Springs has a sister city in Japan?
I used to know that. Where is it?
So the city is called Hanamaki. And really, so from my time in Japan, I lived in Japan for about 2 years, mostly training and brewing at a great sake brewery called Nambu Bijin. That came about through Hot Springs' sister city, Hanamaki. So I went to high school here, and at a kind of a alumni meetup at an Irish pub, someone said to me, "Hey, Ben, you like sake. Did you know about Hot Springs' sister city in Japan?" And I said, "No." And they said the name Hanamaki. And I looked it up. I saw it was in Iwate Prefecture. And I thought, okay, well, the only thing I know about Iwate is it's the home of the Nanbu Toji Brewing Guild, which is the largest, most famous sake brewing guild in Japan. Huh. And I thought, I wonder how far away Hanamaki is from the Nanbu Toji Guild. So I looked it up. And it's in Hanamaki. So I thought, wow, well, that is amazing. I need to talk to the head of the sister city side here in Hot Springs, which was a lady named Mary Zunick. And I got her contact. We talked on the phone. I said, hey, I want to go to Japan and learn how to make sake. And she said, well, believe it or not, we've actually been looking for someone who wanted to go to Japan and train and make sake. And she said, oh, yeah, they have a sake brewing museum there. She said, oh, we take trips there almost every year, and that was just an amazing coincidence.
Everything revolves around Ben, it turns out. We're supposed to be here, Kelly, for some reason. We don't. Kelly and I have been sampling a sample here. They're not in the commercial bottles yet, but something that's very, very clear. It's colorless as well, which, you know, before I get corrected by an email, clear does not mean colorless. but it's something that's got some viscosity. It's got some legs, and it is very delicate in flavor. I don't know if it's my imagination, but along with the kind of subtle fruitiness or maybe a subtle floral component, I don't know if it's my imagination, but I think I can taste a little rice. I think I can taste just a little teeny tiny bit of, not breadiness, but, you know, graininess in there. Is that my imagination?
Yeah, no, it actually makes me happy to hear you say that, because the fruity floral component that you're getting is from the type of yeast that we use for that sake. And that's definitely on purpose. This is actually pretty close to the style of the sake brewery that I trained at in Japan. And I love their style, and I think it's very approachable. But one thing I don't want the fruitiness to do is completely mask the flavor of the rice. Right. So to hear you say that you can taste a little bit of the rice, that makes me happy. I would like for it to be there.
Yeah, it's a very subtle drink. And Kelly, would you, is this anything like any, and Kelly's getting mad at me, but is this anything like any other sake that you've ever had in your life?
It's much different. I've got a very pedestrian kind of blue collar, Applebee's experience with sake. It was usually warm, it was just too much. This is sublime. This is very, I don't have the adjectives you guys have, but the taste is very transparent. It's light on the tongue. I mean, you can linger on it. Whereas previously my experience with sake was just like, okay, that was nice. Can I get an iced tea? So this is really something. It's a revelation.
Yeah, and you say this is, you know, wine strength. This is, would you say, 12% alcohol?
Probably 14-15%, something like that.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Red wine, we're in, you know, kind of red wine, solid red wine territory. I usually liken it for wine drinkers to like a kind of a California Zinfandel, something like that. Those usually get a little up there in ABV, but I think a lot of people, because their first experience is the same as my first experience with sake, the hot, you know, stuff, usually at a suit, you know, some random sushi place. Mm-hmm. The heat, especially for that kind of sake, it shows the alcohol more sometimes. And I think that combined with the small cups, which kind of to Americans look like a shot glass, it gives them the impression that the ABV must be like a spirit. So I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that it's actually not as high as they think it is. But,
well, I mean, hot, in my experience, at least, you know, some of the sake I've had in that experience was not only hot temperature-wise, but hot alcohol-wise as well. And this is not, there's no heat from the alcohol at all. It's beautiful. It's just lovely, and I'm slowly pushing my glass toward the, hoping that I could get maybe just a teeny little sample more.
Sure.
But we have a clear one, and we have a cloudy one as well. So I'm kind of intimidated because, again, this is out of my realm of expertise. Luckily, our listener Mark from Seattle has sent some questions in. Mark is also is a home sake brewer. And so I may be relying on some of his technical questions. And this will thanks, Mark, for your questions. You talked about koji. Mark asks, do you make your own koji, or where, you know, where? What's the origin of your koji? Where does it come from?
The tricky part with this question, well, I guess the word koji gets thrown around quite a bit. And a lot of times using the same word and sometimes talking about different things. Koji can refer to Aspergillus oryzae, which is the mold or the fungus that is used to inoculate the rice. That we do not make. Those are things that technically occur naturally in the wild in Japan. That being said, you've got basically just a handful of makers or preservers of those in Japan. They're only about, they're, oh gosh, the total number, there's probably a few over a dozen, but there's only about four or five that actually provide any sort of real range of options and for different applications and things. So we purchase those spores from Japan. That being said, then from there, do we then produce our own koji in-house in the sense of, do we inoculate our own rice with those spores and make our own koji or koji rice? Yes, we absolutely do. So that we all do in-house, yes. And the biggest reason we do that is because it has such a dramatic impact on the type of sake that we're going to make. That is one of the, we were talking a little bit earlier when we were going around the tour, the different levers that we can pull in order to determine the types of flavor we create, the types of fermentation that we create, how we make our koji is one of those critical levers in terms of creating all, influence all different sorts of characteristics in the sake. So yes, that's all done in-house.
And we may be getting out of ourselves, but if you want to get into the extreme details of how sake is made, you may go back to the archives way back to 2007 with an interview with homebrewer Bob Taylor from Alaska, who went into an extremely detailed step-by-step process, just in case we skip over some of the steps, you know, in this conversation. But you say that it only occurs in Japan. I'm just curious because up until fairly recently, Belgium was known for spontaneously, quote unquote, spontaneously fermented beers, you know, because they would have the cool ships and they would let, you know, cool the wort up in the attic, and they open the louvers to the outside and let the wild yeast, you know, come from the outside. And it was assumed, you know, when I first started brewing that could only happen in Belgium because it's a magic place and Belgium's got magic yeast. But now we know, you know, through people homebrewing and commercial brewers like Grant Chandler at Lost 40 in Little Rock is harvesting yeast and making some wonderful beers. Yes. I don't know if you've had some of those, but
I had some within the last 24 hours.
but we find out that there's good yeast in the air around here. So could it be that through experimentation and trial and error, we could find like an Arkansas koji?
So on the koji side, on the koji spore side, I really don't know. I honestly don't know how far and wide Aspergillus oryzae specifically is in the world. Now on the yeast side, I think we absolutely can cultivate wild yeast in Arkansas and make sake. I think that will be in our future.
I'm tasting the cloudy, unfiltered sake, and I was expecting it to be a lot heavier than the filtered version, but it's not. I mean, it has a half a step more mouthfeel than the original one, but as far as it's a tiny bit less delicate in flavor, but it's still really, I mean, I've had some, you know, when I've told you guys I made makgeolli in the past, a Korean rice wine, and it's, you know, you shake it up and you serve it, and it's pretty chunky. and I got a couple of brands of Nigori sake from the liquor store up in Fayetteville. I didn't like them, frankly. I don't remember what brands they were, but they were one was overly sweet, the other was overly alcoholic. I've still got the bottles in the fridge, which says something. If they were good, they would have been gone. But this is nothing like that. This is extremely delicate. It's not chewy at all as far as the mouthfeel. If I closed my eyes and drank it, I wouldn't necessarily know that it's cloudy. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you, what do you think, Kelly?
I agree. It's just somewhat more opaque than the first, but just by a little.
As far as flavor? Or?
Yeah, we're talking about the, what the cloudiness adds to the weight, the density of the flavor. Yeah, it's just slightly above the clear.
Yeah, and I would say your thoughts about this style are very much by design. We know everyone's first impression with Nigori sake, the cloudy sake, and we know the most common flavor profiles that you'll get with it, which can be definitely heavier, usually sweeter, usually with less acidity on the finish. And this is almost the opposite of those things. So it's lighter than you expect. It's not as sweet as you probably expect. And it's a little more crisper on the finish, which I hope gives people... So yeah, I'll tell you, Nigori sake, the unfiltered, if you will. Well, if we want to get technical, this is... Unfiltered's not quite the word, but it's okay. I think it's a fine shorthand for, you know, what to expect. It's kind of looked down upon in Japan and in the sake world as being not quite as, you know, on the level with your best, you know, totally filtered sakes. We both have the opinion that great Nigori sake is absolutely just as good and some of our favorite sake, and we want to make a style that if you don't know this style, you'll enjoy it. But if you do know this style, and you, maybe you don't have such a high opinion of it, this will make you take a second look.
It's kind of the New England IPA of...
The
traditional brewers look down on the cloudy or hazy beers, you know, that are done that way on purpose. Yeah. Is sort of similar feedback?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. Actually, that's a good point. So, I mean, as Ben said, so Nigori, all that term means is that there is some sort of residual solids of some sort still in there. It doesn't refer to the character of the sake in terms of flavor or weight or alcohol or aroma or anything. There is no designation as to what's in that glass or in that bottle, aside from the fact that it's kind of cloudy. Hmm. And so the depth and breadth of what a Nigori-style sake can be is just as vast, if not more so, than a largely transparent, you know, glass of sake, or like what you just were sipping on. And it's the... As you know, as Ben said, Nigori isn't so much looked down upon in Japan, but it's in a real way, as you can see, it's less refined in a certain way. And you know, Japan has kind of been on a trajectory for a long time where they've been working toward refinement. Just that's the way that the market went, and so Nigori has just sort of taken a back seat. Every brewery makes a few Nigori, and some of them are fantastic, but it's just not the vast majority of what's being made in Japan. That being said, when sake started coming to the U.S. more, or in more volume and more different types of sake started showing up, a lot of people did gravitate toward Nigori styles, actually. It was in terms of style, it was, and still continues to be, very, very popular. Maybe it's not for everybody, but there were signs very early on that, well before the hazy concept really took hold, that the idea of something with some sort of a solids or something in there, and this sort of hazy, cloudy component was something that people, you know, enjoyed. But it, from Japan, they just never brought the depth or breadth of diversity of what that style of sake could be, which is so disappointing. I always felt like it was just, because, like Ben said, they're fantastic. There's so many fantastic sakes with just this general characteristic of being cloudy that are really, really excellent. So we're hoping that kind of for our flagship Nigori, that we could bring something to the table that just isn't really readily available anywhere else, and hopefully start some conversations and let people know that this is, in a way, sort of its own, you know, the possibilities for what this style, for lack of a better word, could be are vast and exciting. So
I dusted off my stir plate again. In the rebrewing of my Hellesbach, I wanted to duplicate the process of brewing the first batch as closely as possible, so I made a 2-liter starter with L09 K Bueno from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Yeast. As with the first go-round, there was vigorous activity in the Erlenmeyer flask on the stir plate in just a couple of hours, and it was pretty much done the next morning, ready to start settling out. So I chilled it, and I poured the beer off, and I pitched the slurry of that starter into about 4.5 gallons of wort at 1070, adding around a minute of oxygen just for insurance. I set it back into the kegerator at around 57 degrees Fahrenheit or 14C, and it was fully active. I mean, chunks of yeast flying around, airlock going, and when I checked back in about 4 hours. LO9K Bueno is a cleanly fermenting lager yeast. I took the batch out of the kegerator on the third day to clean up any diacetyl, but I don't know if it really needed it. I certainly didn't smell any coming out of the airlock. So yesterday, I kegged it. It went from 1070 to 1010. The hydrometer sample was delicious. Can't wait to taste it and compare it to its sibling after a bit of lagering time. You know we love imperial yeast. With 200 billion cells in every easy-to-open packet, my stir plate is usually dusty because I don't use it anymore to make starters for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. Ask your local homebrew store for LO9K Bueno from Imperial Yeast. And, as always, check them out at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com.
So let's step back and get more technical. And again, you're talking to homebrewers, you know, who are very familiar with fermentation. Give us the walking tour shorthand of the sake brewing process and the role of koji and you know, and talk maybe about, you know, Justin, you were talking about those levers that you can pull in the process to affect the, you know, the final product. We're familiar, very familiar with the beer brewing process, but, and maybe you guys can toss back and forth and kind of, you know, walk us through and maybe talk about how you're doing sort of this vertical integration sort of, you know, in a physical sense in your brewery and how you guys are going about it. I'll just take a break and sip the rest of the sake while y'all talk.
Yeah. So while you are sipping that sake, let's start with how we get the rice to the brewery. It has to be milled first. And in the sake world, the milling rate gets talked about quite a bit, and it can have a very real impact on the flavor of the sake. So that's kind of lever number one before it even gets here.
In fact, Mark from Seattle, he says, what is the polish ratio on your rice, and what kind of rice do you use? So there, I'll just stick Mark's questions in.
We have, and I think actually our answer might be a surprise for people who know about polishing ratios in sake. So the conventional wisdom is the more you mill down the rice, and you need a special high-precision mill for that. The more you mill it down, kind of the better the sake. People say that, and I feel like that's how I was initially taught about high-quality sake, or at least that's certainly the impression that I got. And the reason for that, in a way, you can get maybe more refined sake, if you will. But what's happening to the rice as you mill it down? The outsides of a grain of rice usually has more fats and proteins, and the center usually has more starch. So the more you mill down, the more you get rid of fats and proteins. That sometimes can give you rough off flavors, and the more starch you leave behind, which can give you nice, clean, pretty flavors. But I think what people are discovering often now with sake brewing is the proteins in particular can give you some really wonderful depth and richness in your sake. And it's something that Justin and I particularly enjoy. So for us, the way we've been pushing with our polishing ratios is not down more, but actually staying higher as much as we can. So the first round of sake that we made, polishing ratios were 60% and 70%. But we are testing right now 80%, which is that used to in Japan legally be outside of Junmai
special classification.
So the higher their percentage, the more rice that's left on there.
So I guess for if you imagine, say, like a regular table rice or something, you were to go buy off the shelf, you can imagine that's generally polished down to say 92 to 94%, something like that, meaning you're removing about what, 6-8% of that total weight. Okay. There. For a lot of sake that you find on the market, it's generally polished down to 70%, so removing roughly 30% or lower. So the smaller the number, the more polishing basically is going on. And yeah, we're sort of gravitating in the other direction. Not to say that that's bad. Obviously, you can make beautiful, fantastic, refined sakes, for lack of a better word, by polishing those down for the reasons that Ben just explained. That also kind of gets to, you asked about what kind of rice you're using as well too. Japan has cultivated sake specific rice varieties that tend to have more of those desired starches. The way that the rice develops, it develops more of those in the center. That's not necessarily true for other varieties of rice, or table rice or medium or long grain rice, say, that you would find grown here. So the polishing, the actual polishing, becomes less critical in that sense, because you're not necessarily getting closer to a very concentrated, specific, desirable element. And so if you sort of take that out of the scenario and go, okay, if that's not in our equation, then how do we make something that's really sort of refined and delicious? And so we're working with both. We're working with the Isbells. The great thing about working with the Isbells is that they grow and have been growing these sake-specific rice varieties that are well-known. The Yamada Nishikis, the Omachi, Koshi Hikari can be a table rice or a sake-specific variety. And those are available to us. And so we're super lucky in that we're able to work with very closely with them to be able to do that. While at the same time, we're working a lot with medium grain rice that's grown here that nobody talks about. Because it just ends up in the randomly labeled bag of rice by some brand that's, whatever. But rice is incredible. And it's the backbone of sake, along with the water, obviously. And so we're hoping that by sort of flipping that conversation a little bit and leaving more of that in the glass, for, I guess, lack of a better word, to actually hopefully shine a little light on the producers and the rice growing, and being specifically sort of where we're at, say, look, this is what rice inherently is, and here's what it can be. And so we're trying to work with that as well.
So in the same way that craft brewers are working with maybe even craft malters, who are working with farmers who are growing either heirloom varieties of grains or gluten-free grains, or experimenting with other grains that are outside the traditional barley or things that we are, brewers have become comfortable brewing with, y'all might discover some sake or some rice for sake that might not have been discovered before.
Totally. And that's what we're saying. We have a technical advisor we're working with in Japan who works with the brewery Nomobijin that Ben was with. He just left yesterday, and we just spent the last couple of weeks with him making koji and doing some test batches and things like that. This is the first time he's had his hands really into this stuff and working with it. And his comments were, this is really easy to work with. It's in a way, it makes, how is it going to, in terms of flavor and character, what is it going to become? That's what we're trying to figure out. But in terms of just something to work with, it's actually really desirable to work with. In a way, it makes our lives easier in a lot of ways to actually work with this rice, And so it's sake is made from rice, I think just to highlight that, I'd like to think it should be something that's empowering, I'd like to think that it demonstrates the value of, rice just in general is kind of a commodity product that people don't always put a lot of thought or consideration into. They'll take whatever's off the shelf, but it's really special. And the work that goes into growing and making that is really special. And, the depth and breadth of what that can be, to really explore that. I feel like we kind of have that sort of our role of, being here, positioned and located where we are. And so to do that, and then alongside, obviously, working with the sake specific varieties and doing that as well too, you can create something that is wholly unique in that trajectory as well. And so to try and put both those worlds so they can sort of coexist out there.
Yeah, I would just like to say, to kind of put a fine point on that, to put a fine point on that, to show how good sake can be from not Japanese varietals, not sake-specific varietals. The sake that you've had right now is made from an Arkansas medium grain called Titan. Yes, so the sake that we've been enjoying is Arkansas rice. The only use that I know of for this rice, you know, it's like Justin said, a lot of people don't know where some of our agricultural products go. The only use I've heard for this rice is Kellogg's uses it for Rice Krispies.
So, well, this is a better treat than the than the Rice Krispie treat. No offense, Mom.
could be a food pairing. I don't know.
Yeah, I could drink a lot of. Now, you don't call it origami sake because if you drink too much, your legs fold up, right? That's not. I'm sorry.
That won't be our marketing material.
Kelly's shaking his head. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist. We haven't talked about the water, which is the other, you know, highly influential ingredient, I'm assuming. You're getting your own water. You dug a hole, and now you're getting your water from down below us, right?
Yeah. So we use on-site well water. So, you know, in brewing, there's some things you want, some things you don't want. Water that has good nutrients for yeast, of course, is great, and that is phosphorus, potassium, magnesium. There's a few things that are not good for brewing. Iron is one. It's a thing you generally don't want in your drinking water either. Manganese as well. So, you know, if you're looking at your water report, you know, you've got your desirables and things that you don't want. We were pretty lucky. I'd say Arkansas generally, compared to most water in the U.S., is on the softer side. And one of the good things about that is you may not have a ton of nutrients, but it's also usually lower in bad things like iron. So, and that's exactly what our well water is like. So yeah, we've been brewing with our water straight from the well and, you know, made some good sake. So we feel pretty good about it.
That's awesome. Just don't go out in Piercy to get it. I had a cousin who lived out at Piercy and they had sulfur. You know, you walked in their house, you could smell their, it's like, oh.
I've never experienced that myself. I've heard the stories of natural sulfur in well water.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Nah, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Now talk about, before we get it, we strayed away from it, but Justin wanted you to kind of get back to those levers,
sure.
You know, the control levers that you can, how can you influence the process so that these sakes taste different using the same ingredients?
Oh my goodness. So these levers, each one of these could be a show in and of its own. So I guess we'll just kind of,
we'll
run down. Yeah. So first thing to start is, what is the rice variety you use? And then how do you polish, to what degree are you going to polish that? So that's going to be one component.
I'm sorry. Can I add a fun fact onto the polishing?
Most definitely.
So people might be interested in, how low has anyone ever polished rice to make sake? And the answer, believe it or not, is less than 1%.
Oh my God.
Now, was that done for, you know, flavor reasons? I don't know. Is it amazing marketing? Yes, it is.
Yeah,
actually, the brewery that did that makes wonderful sake, and I love them.
Yeah, but it's an important point, too, because we were talking about a lot of times the more polishing is associated with more refinement or more quality, but those high precision milling machines and stuff have improved, realizing that it's sort of a game of diminishing returns past a certain point. And so at what point does that value proposition just sort of drop out? And then the base of your value proposition is, how much time did I mill this grain down? And everybody has access to the same equipment, then what makes that, you know, unique and special? So it's a lever, and it's a critical one.
And it seems wasteful too. I mean,
right? There's different ways of look. Right? There's absolutely. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. The nice thing is, what gets milled away, a lot of that rice flour, there's other purposes for that.
Oh, okay.
It can be, you know, mixed into. It can be used for fertilizers, for feeds. It can be used in other food products. It can be used in cosmetics and different sorts of things. So a lot of it does get repurposed in some other capacity. Yeah. So the amount of waste that actually comes from that is very little, if any, so especially in Japan, because you have so many other products and food products and things that are rice related or derived and things like that. So it's just snacks and crackers and all sorts of stuff. So the nice thing is that there isn't a lot of waste that really comes from that. Yeah. But in terms of that specific lever, where you're going to get a real drastic difference is where you start from, say, you know, table rice or closer to a brown rice, down to maybe about 50%. Beyond that, it's really that curve starts to kind of taper off, you know. But it is one critical component, obviously. And
we should explain that that there's no malting process in making sake. It's the microorganisms that do the work of that conversion.
So let's talk about koji, and let's talk about the idea of malting, right? Because I personally don't mind the term malting for making koji, even though koji is kind of that plus it. That's only like maybe half of what making koji is. But you know, if you're talking about saccharification, turning your starches into sugars, that's part of the koji process, the koji making process. Although it continues to happen once you add the koji into your tank, because the koji is making amylase, that is turning starches into sugars, and it's making more than it really needs for the amount of rice that's there. So when you add it into your tank, you can add more just steamed rice, and that extra amylase is going to keep breaking down the extra steamed rice that you put in. But the other thing that it's doing that is very critical to the character of sake and the flavor profile is it's also releasing protease that's breaking the proteins down into amino acids. And one of those amino acids is glutamic acid. That is the flavor of umami, which, you know, I think people are now starting to say and hear the word umami and get to know what it is. I think that shorthand, you know, that or what we often say that's, you know, close enough is savory. And that function of breaking down proteins into amino acids, this is what happens when you grill meats or stew tomatoes or, you know, age cheese. It's a pretty common process in food fermentation. I like to call making koji, it's not just the, you know, the malting step, but it's the umami step. And it's the source of sake's very high umami flavor, which is, it's not so, your tongue is not so sensitive to umami, so it kind of takes a higher concentration to really register, but it's always there in sake. And it's one of the key components to helping sake pair easily with food. Huh. Yes.
Yeah. And it ties back into the rice milling or polishing as well, because a lot of the nutrients that are then going to break down into those amino acids that give it that sort of complex flavor are the ones that rest a lot of times in the outer layer, more closer to the outer layers of the grain. And so the type of sake that has come to be desired in Japan is sort of born out of the unique historical and cultural ecosystem of what Japan has gone through with making sake. Whereas that, and it's delicious and it's incredible, and the craft is absolutely inspiring. That being said, the flavors of what's being created based on a very sort of specific value sets that are sort of just developed along with economic influences and all these other things, translated into more polishing and diminishing the components that would result in those more sort of creating those more complex amino acids and things that is part of the fermentation that koji would, those enzymes it would produce, which gives you that complex umami and that flavor, which is incredible flavor. In Japan, a lot of times they would refer to that, in Japan they call it zatsumi, which is like off flavor. As opposed to categorizing it as character, it was how do we suppress this, which is how you end up with more rice milling, rice polishing.
Is it a matter of the better the technology, the more sort of refined these flavors became, and sort of like the more the older stuff tasted worse because it was because it did taste worse, but because it didn't taste as clean or as refined.
And the older stuff is old, right? I mean, if it's maybe there's nothing necessarily wrong with it, but you know, as you become more affluent, as other beverage and drinks options become available, if you're a craftsman and you're looking to refine your craft, and you know, you start reaching for those levers that allow you to do so, you know, and one of those levers was, say, rice polishing, and then, you know, transparency and clarity and cleanness, and those were things that just didn't exist in sake 100 years ago, or 200 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 1,000 years ago. So they're just kind of naturally gravitating toward the thing they never had. Which you see in a lot of different things,
too.
You know, it makes sense, but at the same time, you take sakes that would, say, be sort of not so mainstream styles in Japan. You can take them here to the U.S. or other places, and they get fantastic responses. And sometimes it really sort of startles a lot of Japanese producers because they're sakes that they don't bring to their tastings,
right?
You know, they're not, if you ask them to say, hey, bring three bottles to show off, it's not stuff that they would necessarily choose themselves, but they're finding, especially over the last 10 to 15 years or so, is that when they're going to the US, when they're traveling Europe and they're going on tours, they're finding that the sake that was this one sort of special different thing that we did just for the sake of, you know, preserving technique, or you know, keeping something of that style in the portfolio just in case kind of a thing, gets a really, really excellent response. And a lot of it is, and a lot of those sakes are ones that have a lot of more of that complex flavor.
I would also add, just historically, the style tied to technological changes. Rice polishing was a big one. I would also add easy access to refrigeration. And that's where...
And sanitization, maybe?
Sanitization, absolutely. I would also add on to that control and propagation of yeast, that technology. Those all had huge impacts on how sake was made, that kind of led to... what is, you know, a very popular style in craft sake, which is, you know, big, fruity, aromatic, you know, giving yeasts, the low temp, slow fermentation, very refined, light on the palate sake that comes from milling down the rice a lot. So those you can look through the past 130 years or so and see these technological changes happen, and then kind of track the style to why is it the way it is now. And definitely that's a delicious style of sake. The first sake that you tasted is kind of a version of that.
From that school.
Yeah, it absolutely is from that school, and it tastes good. But the world of sake is so much bigger and diverse. So, you know, of course we want to show off not just how sake's been sort of funneled through technology, as Justin said, kind of the extra things, the special things that you never know how much people are going to enjoy it until you take it out and you realize, oh, this kind of what we thought was a weird thing is actually a really wonderful thing that a lot of people would enjoy.
Yeah, and so I guess, and then getting back to your question about the koji and all that stuff too.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, we're really great at tangents. If that's
welcome to the show.
Yeah. No, but you know, so koji, right? So this is critical for making sake, obviously. So I mentioned earlier there we get our koji spores from Japan. We have a choice of a handful of makers, and each of those makers or suppliers has many, many different kinds of koji spores, which all have very different properties and sort of what sorts of enzymes they are going to create or generally produce more or less of when cultivated on rice at different temperatures over different time. And so that koji in general, you know, when you're making rice koji from those spores, you know, it could be that time could be as short as 30 hours, or it could be as more as high, 60 hours or more. Mm. And so the temperature, the to oxygen, and the amount of time that during that phase that the rice and the koji spends at different temperatures in that phase, it's going to result in it becoming koji that will produce different types of enzymes later down the road. So controlling that process is a big component. So it's the type of spore, but then how do we then choose to handle that in right. the process of growing that onto and into the rice over that period that's, you know, a day to 2 days or more, you know.
And that's where the science meets the art, right? I mean, that's like in brewing beer, you know, you've got all these things, you've got all these levers, you've got all these, you're working with a live agricultural product, and it's bringing all that together in a way to make some delicious stuff. Well, you guys have been more than generous with your time, and I, like I say, I'm. We could talk for another hour. I'm not sure that Kelly would. We're getting in so deep now that Kelly is probably just wanting another glass of of sake.
We can supply.
But I can't tell you how happy I am that y'all are here in Hot Springs, I can't wait to see what you come up with, and I can't wait to find it on my local shelves. Ben and Justin, thank you very much, and hopefully this will be just the first visit. Maybe we'll come back when you're up to speed and going full production.
Oh, please do. We'd love to have you all back. Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming out. I said you're all welcome back anytime. We have more than a handful of things we didn't touch on. Still today, so.
We just got started. I've even got more questions from Mark that we didn't get to. So, thanks, guys.
All right,
thanks
you.
So much.
Well, thanks again to Ben and Justin. We could have talked for a lot longer, but they had been very generous with their time before then to give Kelly and me a tour before we sat down to talk. And of course, thanks to Kelly for his reluctant contribution. I think he did really well. He's been intimidated by the whole tasting thing, but you know, you just talk about what you taste. Ben and Justin say they're targeting later this year to get fully up and running, and in the meantime, look for Origami Sake on the socials to keep up to date and check the Basic Brewing Instagram for some photos that I'm going to post. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com where you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page, of course. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. So until next time, till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.